He turned on the radio and we listened to country music. I say we listened. I had no idea what song was playing or who was singing it. All I could think of was my husband. Where was he? Was he hurt? Was he dead? Car lights shone through the back of the van and we got out, meeting the officer as he came around the back side of our vehicle. It was dark and hard to tell what the feller looked like. Are you Mrs. McQuaid? Yes. I was told that you reported a missing person. Yes, my husband. His name is Bob McQuaid. Everyone calls him Pork Chops. He works down at the factory. He didn't come home from work. He's over 4 hours late now. Is this the way you found the bike? He sounded young. Yes, I said, exactly. He examined the bike. Looks like he got off and left it sitting here. Maybe he took off on foot. Maybe caught a ride with somebody. He would never do that, I said. He would never leave his bike on the side of the road like this. He loves this bike. The officer shone his lights along the edge of the road. Look, there are no skid marks. This bike was not pulled over in an emergency stop. There is no indication of an emergency of any type. He turned back to me. Ma'am, there's no sign of any kind of struggle or foul play. No sign of any kind of emergency. He took the lid off the gas tank and checked it, looked at the helmet, the gloves lying neatly across the seat. Tell you what, let's go back to the station and fill out the paperwork for a missing persons report. And if he doesn't show up within the next few hours, we'll take it from there. The next few hours, I said, Bob could be dead in the next few hours. Look, ma'am, it's obvious that he wasn't run off the road. Like I said, there's no skid marks and no damage to the bike. There's no sign of a struggle. It doesn't look like he had any motor vehicle trouble. The bike starts and sounds fine. There are simply no signs to indicate any type of emergency situation here. But how do we know somebody didn't pull up behind him with a gun and holler, pull over or we'll shoot? I ask. Well, tell you what, ma'am, let's go downtown and we'll figure it all out. Thomas Jeffrey drove Bob's bike home that night. I drove Cookie's van and followed the officer into Mercy to fill out paperwork and answer questions about Bob. At the police station, the young officer turned me over to a hefty middle-aged woman who proceeded to ask me questions about Bob. She wanted to know his full name, birthday, social security number, all the usual stuff. Do you have a photo ID of him? She asked. No, Bob never had a photo made. How about driver's license? He should be in the system. He didn't have a license, I mumbled. What? She asked. I cleared my throat. Bob doesn't have a license. Can you give me a description? About 5'9", around 180 pounds, sandy hair, thin features, hazel eyes. Any tattoos or scars or other identifying marks? No, I said. Bob doesn't believe in tattoos. Okay, how about clothes? What was he wearing? I fidgeted a bit, trying to remember what Bob had on that morning before he left. I felt stupid. He had on his work clothes, of course, the same thing he always wore. A light blue shirt, well, one of those work shirts like mechanics and janitors wear. It had a little round sign above the left pocket and said Bob in red cursive writing. And he had on navy blue pants and a pair of work boots. He was wearing an old wind-up watch. Good, she said. Anything else? I thought for a moment, trying to come up with anything that would help find my husband. A ring, I said. He was wearing a ring, a silver spider with a turquoise eyes and an M on the abdomen. How about family? Does he have siblings or parents that he might have gone to visit? He has a sister in West Virginia, I said, but he never visits her because she's crazy. And he has a brother that's in London. That's London, Kentucky, not London, England. But they haven't spoken since 1976. They had a falling out back then. Write the names of his siblings down for me, she said. We'll contact them. While I was writing, she said, how about friends? Does he have any friends that he might have gotten into a vehicle with? I handed her the paper with his siblings' names on it. Bob wouldn't want me telling an officer that he was involved in a militia group. but now his life might depend on it. Well, he has some buddies that he trades guns with and stuff, but I don't know any of their last names. Do you know what town they live in? No, I said. After I filled out the paperwork, she told me that they had sent a search party out in search of Bob. I said I wanted to join the search party. Called Cookie and told her that all that was going on and went to help look for my husband. I don't know how many men and women looked for Bob all through the remainder of the night. Early the next morning, I had come back to where I had parked the van next to a police officer's car, and I was about to check in with my sister again when someone handed me a cup of coffee and said, "Thought you might need this." I looked up, and there was Daniel Ransom. Of course he would come out to see how the manhunt was going. He was, after all, the sheriff of the closest town. "Thank you," I said. I took a drink of the coffee. "Sorry about your husband. We'll do everything we can to help you find him." "He wouldn't leave," I said. "Did you check your bank account?" he asked. I looked at him for a moment. Was he suggesting that Bob would withdraw all of his money and out of the bank and just run away? "No," I said. "He never had an account. Bob paid for everything in cash." "Then no credit cards either?" "No." "Look," I said, "I appreciate you and all of these people helping, but I'm telling you, Bob would never leave. Something has happened to him. He wouldn't park his bike and walk away. Bob is predictable, and he always does everything exactly the same way every single day." "Hmm," the sheriff said. "Hmm, what?" I asked. "Nothing. Just trying to figure it out." We rejoined the search party, and for 3 days that area was searched. Daniel Ransom would leave to go take care of other duties, but then he would rejoin the search every time. He was always checking on me to make sure I was holding up okay or to bring me something to drink. The pond was dragged and my heart was beating furiously. I was so afraid that maybe Bob had gotten off his bike and somehow fallen in the pond and drowned. But there was nothing pulled from that pond except an old tackle box and a turtle shell. Local families searched their barns and sheds and fields. At 6 o'clock on the third day, the search was called off. Bob was declared a missing adult, and his case was put on an active file, whatever that meant. "How can y'all call off the search?" I said to Daniel Ransom. "These people are exhausted. They need rest. And it's obvious now that he is nowhere in the immediate vicinity. It's time to follow the leads and let the detectives do their work. If your husband has been kidnapped or worse, then we aren't going to find the answers tramping through the fields and the woods. Your husband obviously isn't here." I turned around and leaned against Cookie's van, which I had kept the whole 3 days, along with her cell phone. I hadn't considered the possibility that I might not find Bob. I hadn't cried. But I also hadn't slept in 3 nights or eaten more than a bite or two the whole time. My head was hurting and I was shaking. I laid over on the van and forgot that all these people were there. All I could think of was that Daniel Ransom had said the police were calling off the search, and it dawned on me that it could be weeks or months or years before I saw Bob again, if I ever saw him again. My husband was officially a missing person. It was the worst feeling I had ever known. I guess I had a bit of a meltdown because I cried. I sunk right down to the ground and cried. I felt a hand on my shoulder. "Don't cry," Daniel Ransom said. "We'll find him." "It isn't fair," I said. "It isn't fair." "No, it's not," he said. "Come on, starving yourself and going without sleep isn't going to help you find him." He radioed someone and told them that he was taking me home and said he'd call them in a bit to come pick him up. He opened the door to Cookie's van. "Get in." "What are you doing?" I asked. "You haven't slept in days. I can't let you behind the wheel of a vehicle, so I'm driving you home." He asked me for directions, and I gave them to him in a numb daze. When we crossed the bridge, I said, "Bob always thought someone was under the bridge." The sheriff stopped the van. "What? Why?" "Did you mention this to any of the officers?" "No," I said. "I just now thought of it." He got out and walked around, examining the bridge and the area around it. Then he got back in the van. "Why did he think someone was under the bridge?" I looked out the window toward the little creek that ran under it. "You'll think I'm crazy," I said. "You'll think he's crazy." At this point, it doesn't matter what anyone thinks, he said. Your husband is missing, and if you want us to find him, you need to tell everything you can about him. Okay, I said. Bob saw something when he was a kid. He lived in Houstonville. It was the late 60s. You don't look that old, he said. Bob's a lot older than I am. We got married when I was a teenager. He was already about 30. Oh, he said, go on. When he was a kid, an airplane, a highly specialized fighter plane, crashed near his home. His mom and dad saw it. His brother saw it, too. His sister saw it. Bob was a little boy, getting his hair cut over at the barber shop. They ran out of the shop and saw flames blazing. And the pilot, he died. They saw that man die. Bob said the government came around and told them that what they had seen was top secret and they weren't supposed to talk about it. That airplane was a top secret project. The U.S. military wasn't supposed to have anything like that at that point in history. Later, when Bob was a teenager, he slipped up and talked about it. And ever since then, he's believed that the CIA or the FBI or somebody was after him. I couldn't read the sheriff's expression. It was a mixture between that listening look people get and that you all belong in the loony bin look. Huh, he said after several seconds. Let's go up to your house. When we pulled into my driveway beside my truck, he let the van idle as he looked over at it. Is that Bob's truck? No, mine, I said. He looked over at Bob's shed, his mouth twisted up like he was toying with some notion. He cut the engine. What's in that shed?